True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Since the late 1920s, Camp Scott, northeastern Oklahoma, was a retreat for Girl Scouts to play, learn, and grow in the great outdoors. But on the night of June 13, 1977, it was the scene of a grisly murder that left three girls dead and a community terrified. The victims, 8-year-old Lori Farmer, 9-year-old Michelle Gousset, and 10-year-old Doris Milner, were killed in their sleep as their friends and camp counselors slept just a few feet away. They had arrived just the day before they were killed and were getting ready for a 2-week trip at the camp with their friends. A counselor found all three bodies scattered along a trail leading to the camp showers, wrapped in their sleeping bags. The rest of the girls were sent home without being told much, but learned of the murders when they reunited with their parents, who were praying their daughters were not killed. But a dark mark started growing at the camp 2 months prior to the killings. During a training session for camp counselors, a tent was ransacked. Left behind was a handwritten note with a prophetic message warning three campers would be murdered. That note was dismissed as a prank and thrown in the trash. Other events leading up to the girls' arrival came to light during the investigation.
If I had known a tent had been slashed the night before Lori was to get a bus to go, I would have never let her go. And when we got up there and saw the arrangement of the area, it is not the way we thought our child was going to be in a camp area. I would not have stayed in the tent Lori was in as an adult. I would not have stayed there. I would have been frightened.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Today's show is brought to you by HelloFresh. Please visit HelloFresh.com and use the promo code TCB30 to save $30 off your first week of deliveries when you subscribe. So today we're talking about the Girl Scout murders. And Camp Scott, where this occurred, was located in Locust Grove, Oklahoma. It had been a retreat for Girl Scouts and Brownies since 1928. Its 410 wooded acres accommodated 140 campers and 30 staff members. Its central trail, the Cookie Trail, led to 10 elevated tents dotted throughout clearings in the woods. Campers Lori Lee Farmer, Michelle Goose, and Doris Denise Milner were snatched from their tent less than 24 hours after they arrived at Camp Scott for what was to be a really fun-filled 2-week visit. Their battered bodies were found the next morning. Now, these crimes were shocking, but they didn't occur without any warning. 2 months before the murders, during a training session, a counselor's tent had been ransacked. A handwritten note had been left behind that read, "Three campers will be murdered," but the counselors dismissed this note as a prank and it was thrown away. So come join us, if you will, at the quiet end of the bar as we discuss the 1977 murders of three young girls in a setting which would otherwise seem idyllic. This is a case still shrouded in mystery, with suggestions of an unfair trial, an unknown accomplice, and Native American influences, including a medicine man's curse and shape-shifting. We'll be keeping it real, but we would be remiss if we didn't mention these supernatural aspects of the investigation. Dick brought a wonderful Oklahoma brew, which we'll get to, but first, a word of thanks to our TCB 5-star reviewers. So thank you so much, History Buff, Farmer Lovey, Maggie the Magpie, Donna 4620, Dr. Molly Cools, Christina Todd, Stevie Diaz, RFK 5876, Flightless Bones, Philly Yoga Girl, CS 7981, Kamace, YR Boline, Eastside 25, and, of course, science-loving biatch.
You always seem to pick one of the more interesting names as your final one.
I like to end it that way. Yeah. It's fun.
It's a good one.
Yeah. What do we have for beer?
We have a beer from Prairie Artisan Ales, which is in Tulsa, Oklahoma, called Bomb, with an exclamation point.
Exciting.
So I guess I should say bomb.
Sure.
So this is a beer that's an American double or imperial stout, which, as followers of this program know, I've drunk a few of those. So these are beers that are inspired by Russian imperial stouts. Most are barrel-aged in bourbon or whiskey barrels. Some are infused with chocolate or coffee. They tend to be big alcoholic beers and very full-bodied. So this particular one, Bomb, poured a pitch-black color with a small dark beige head. This head disappeared pretty quickly. It's got a nice aroma of coffee, vanilla bean, alcohol, chocolate, and a little faint spice. Almost like a chili.
Oh, that sounds pretty good, actually.
This is a wonderful beer. The taste is coffee and alcohol right up front, followed by chocolate and a little bit of chili pepper. And as it warms up, it warms you up. Well, it's full-bodied, very smooth, and it's 13% alcohol by volume.
Whoa, that's a lot of alcohol.
So be careful with that one, kiddies.
Okay, we'll share the bottle. How's that?
We will. Or we might make it maybe two-thirds, one-third, something like that. Or do we have to share?
In whose favor?
I'm the two-third.
Okay. Well, probably if we want me to stay awake.
Okay.
Okay. All right, let's open it.
Or we'll just do half and half, and I'll finish what you don't want.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right.
All right, let's open it. All right, Dickie, let's go to the quiet end and drink this and have a talk.
Let's do that. It is truly a quiet end today.
Yes. Which we need, because these are some tough crimes to talk about. Not only creepy, but really sad.
They sure are.
Really sad victims.
These were little kids, 8, 9, 10-year-olds.
Yeah, off to have fun.
Yeah. Who would have thought?
Well, nobody. I'm sure parents never would have thought this would happen.
No, not in a million years.
Right. So I'm going to start out in to honor them a little bit and just talk a little bit about the victims. They didn't live very long, but they were people who had things in their lives that are important to mention.
Absolutely.
So Michelle Heather Goose, she was 9, and she was a member of local Girl Scouts JJ Troop 624 in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. She loved to play soccer, she was a good student, and she was an avid reader. Michelle was shy, she had this wide smile, and her birthday was only a few weeks away. Her parents had planned to give her a 10-speed bicycle, and Michelle, she wanted to be a math teacher like her mother, Georgianne. She had a big brother named Mike, who was 13 when she was killed. On her first night at camp, Michelle wrote a letter to her aunt, and she was excited to tell her that she was in the last tent in the unit. So that'll come up later, as it really wasn't a good spot to be, right?
Right.
Right. So Doris Denise Milner, age 10, she had sold Girl Scout cookies to family, friends, and neighbors to save enough money to pay for her camping trip. Doris got straight A's in the fourth grade and had been honored for having the highest achievement and best study habits in her class. Doris actually taught herself to read when she was just 4 years old. She loved ice skating, tap dancing, and gymnastics, and she had a 5-year-old little sister. Now, in her Bible at home, Doris's mother keeps the never-mailed letter that she wrote on her first night at camp. And in this letter, Doris told her mom that she didn't like camp. It was raining, and she wasn't going to want to stay there for the whole 2 weeks. So
yeah.
She wasn't liking it right away.
Well, I mean, a lot of kids don't like camp right away.
That's true.
You know, they get there, their whole lives are upheaved for a while, and they say, yeah, you know, it's ugly, rainy, I don't like the kids in my tent, I don't want to stay here.
Yeah, it's all new.
Then they end up loving it.
Sure, sometimes. Now, Lori Lee Farmer, age 8, she was a gifted and sweet little girl who could flawlessly recite the Pledge of Allegiance when she was only 16 months old. She skipped the second grade and was tested with an IQ of 130. Now, Lori's 9th birthday was to fall just 6 days after she was murdered. Her family planned to visit her at camp to celebrate. Lori had 1 brother and 2 sisters, and the first night of camp, Lori, too, wrote a letter that would never be mailed. The letter was found by police in her tent, addressed to her mom, her dad, her sisters, and her brother. She told them she was getting ready for bed, and that she'd been having fun with her two new friends, Michelle and Doris, who were sharing the tent with her. Now, before the Girl Scouts arrived for their camping trip on June 12, 1977, some strange incidents had occurred. Camp Ranger Ben Woodward, who was a caretaker living at Camp Scott, found a slashed tent flap with a 4 to 5 inch square section removed sometime before the Scouts arrived on that Sunday.
So right before they arrived, he found the slashed tent.
Yes, that very day.
Okay.
Now, on the Saturday, which was the day before the session opened, the camp director's husband, Richard Day, saw a strange man walking around the camp carrying a clear plastic jug. A camp counselor reported two incidents during the week before camp began. Two staff members were followed one night by someone with a flashlight, who wouldn't identify himself, and in a separate incident, a staff member saw a strange man enter their tent. So now, camp counselor Michelle Hoffman also found the threatening note in the camp's unit less than 2 months before the murders. And that was back on April 1st, 1977, when a cabin where two Tulsa troop leaders were staying was ransacked and $53 in cash was stolen.
So there's been some mysterious goings-on up to a couple months before campers arrived.
Well, and even before that, back in the summer of 1976, a Peeping Tom incident had been reported. And on June 12th, the day the girls arrived at camp, the police were called to investigate a burglary at a nearby farmhouse. So all of this will come up when we discuss the civil suit the parents filed against the Scout Council and the insurance company for negligence leading to their daughters' deaths. But in total, 140 girls came to the camp, Camp Scott, on June 12, 1977, before these events occurred.
The murders occurred.
The murders, yes.
I'm just wondering, are these common things that happen at camps that aren't occupied? I mean, are there people wandering around with flashlights or water jugs or slashing tent flaps or stuff like that? And it seems to me there's some weird things going on.
Yes. Well, it definitely does. And I don't know how common that is at other camps.
Yeah. So I don't know, was this stuff, obviously it wasn't enough for them to consider not having camp or postponing camp.
Well, maybe they should have at least considered having some security or something looking back.
Yeah.
Well, during that night, someone came through the back of the tent where Michelle, Doris, and Lori were sleeping, and all three girls were hit in the head with a blunt object. So this possibly killed two of them instantly, and the third girl was bound, gagged, and made to walk to the edge of the camp rope. So just after 6 a.m. on June 13th, camp counselor Carla Willite was walking to the shower when she noticed some sleeping bags beside the camp road. And that's when she saw the body of Doris Milner. And zipped into two other sleeping bags were the bodies of Michelle and Lori. The three girls had been bludgeoned, sexually assaulted, and dumped about 150 yards from their tent. So this was quite shocking, as you can imagine.
That only begins to describe it.
I can't think of anything like this ever happening beforehand.
No.
I couldn't find anything. And it's nothing that I would have ever thought of. Now, the camp was closed, and the campers were sent home. Evidence found at the camp included a red flashlight, a partial roll of electrical tape, some rope, a pair of glasses, a bloody shoe, and boot tracks inside the tent. Not a bloody shoe, but bloody shoe and boot prints.
Bloody shoe
print. Just to be clear on that.
Bloody shoe print and bloody boot prints.
Right.
Okay.
But no actual shoe was found.
No shoe with blood.
Nope. So the campers were sent home on chartered buses to the scouting headquarters in Tulsa. Now, of course, the girls had no idea about the murders. They didn't tell them. And Mr. and Mrs. Kitzmiller, parents of a 9-year-old camper, heard that three girls at the camp had been killed when they were driving. They heard it on the radio. So this was terrifying for them, as you can well imagine.
Yeah, your horrible thought is, what if it's our daughter?
Of course. And they were in a panic, not knowing if their daughter Nancy was one of the victims, until they finally did meet up with her in Tulsa.
Fortunately.
Yes. So the girls didn't know what was going on. They just put them in buses and sent them to their parents, where their parents could speak with them, which I think was wise.
Yeah. Although
I mean, what are you going to do?
I was reading the little book about it. There was one girl who did see one of the bodies.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And did she tell other kids about it, I would imagine?
She probably did.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that all the campers were unaware.
Okay. Well, they probably knew something was going on. I know that the line they were given, the official line, was that there was trouble with the water.
Right.
Yeah.
So on June 14th, this is the day after the bodies were found, camper Wilma Tennant reported to her parents and police that she had been woken up in the night by screams. Wilma had reported the screams to a counselor who told her to go back to sleep. So I guess nobody else heard this.
Or said they did. I mean, most kids sleep like rocks anyway.
Right. The wooden floor of the murdered girl's tent was removed for examination because it was covered in blood. Tennant's shoe and print and a boot print were found outside and inside of the tent. No murder weapon was found. The next day, the 15th, a team of specially trained tracking dogs was flown in from Pennsylvania. The three dogs would help establish an entrance and exit point of the killer. Girl Scout Council offered a $1,000 reward from donations made by its board of directors and a Tulsa bank. Investigators revealed what evidence they had found to the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation.
So throughout the state, security was increased, in all camps, of course. A group of campfire girls who left Tulsa on June 14th to begin their summer camps. They were accompanied by armed guards, because this had just happened, and people are in a panic. You know, this person hasn't been caught.
Right. I mean, this is like the day after. So we know that there are three murders. There's plenty of other camps that are in operation. I'm sure they're scrambling for guards and increased security.
So do you think those were guards from the government or the army or what?
Or local police departments?
Oh, maybe.
Or maybe the National Guard?
I don't know. I think I did read that the National Guard was involved.
And did they, I mean, they accompanied the campers to the camp. Did they stay at the camp and stand guard?
No, I don't believe so. I think once they were in and did the search that most of them left, but they did leave a couple there to guard.
Well, I sure would.
Yeah. I just think I'd keep my kid home, to be honest.
Well, that'd be the first thing.
Yeah.
But barring that, if I'm going to go to camp, I would want to have guards at the camp while my kid is there.
Sure. Well, Girl Scout counselors were questioned, and the eyeglasses and eyeglass case that were found along the killer's path ended up belonging to one of the counselors. But the killer's path, it was determined, went right past this counselor's tent. Also, investigators learned that a blue denim purse had been stolen from the counselor's tent. So somebody had been poking around there, not just, you know, someone had been hanging around stalking, don't you think? It really feels that way.
No question.
Someone was watching, and they had decided that that was the best tent, I'm thinking, and those girls were just unlucky to be there.
Yeah. I think from reading the book, lighting was pretty non-existent. There were some kerosene lanterns over the outhouses.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, you know, nighttime, things were pitch black.
Right.
So campers were walking around with flashlights. And this particular tent was in a group of tents. There were seven per group. And this was in the back of the camp.
Right.
So it was more secluded to begin with. And tent seven, where the girls disappeared from, was more secluded than the others.
Right. And in some of the literature, it's referred to as tent eight, but that's because the counselor's tent would be seven in that case.
Right.
Right. But it was quite a ways from the counselor's tent.
It was.
Yep.
And it was dark.
Yes. Now, didn't you say something about there may have been more girls in that tent, except something with the count? What was that you were talking about?
Well, it just was, there was a mention that there's seven tents. There's, I don't know, eight groups of seven tents or something like that.
Okay.
And there's supposed to be four per tent, so there's supposed to be 28 girls in the Kiowa group.
Okay.
But there were only 27, so one tent only had three girls.
And that was that tent.
And that was the tent where the three were abducted and killed.
Now, I wonder why that was the tent with only the three girls. Was it because it was the last one they were counting? Or was it the least desirable because of its location, I wonder?
Who knows?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how they decided who went where.
Right, I don't either.
And the girls were all allowed to pick who they wanted to room with.
Yes, right. Although if you don't really know anyone, it's kind of tough.
It sure is.
You kind of end up with people, I would think.
Yeah, well, it sounds like that's what these three did.
Yeah, but they seem to like each other.
Yeah.
at least according to one of the girls' letters. Now, what I thought was really surprising was that the Boy Scout camp, just 3 miles away, stayed open. So of the 130 boys in that camp, Camp Garland, only 13 sets of parents picked up their sons that Monday, the 13th.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is interesting. You know, if my son is at the Boy Scout camp across the street, virtually across the street.
Right, right.
I mean, they're pretty close to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I've learned that there's been a killing at the Girl Scout camp.
A mass killing, really. Isn't three a mass killing?
I guess it is.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd be at that Boy Scout camp first thing in the morning taking my kid home.
I would think so. But I wonder, is there a different attitude because they were boys? That's part of it, I think.
Well, that could be.
Seems to me, you know, years back, boys were treated more like little men and weren't actually coddled as much as they are now. And I don't mean that in a bad way, because coddling can be good. But I think boys were treated a little differently.
They're supposed to be tougher? Is that what you mean?
I think so, yeah. They were supposed to be tougher. They were less likely to be victims. At least that's the way my parents were.
Yeah, I guess. But I would still be really reluctant to leave my son at the Boy Scout camp.
Oh, sure, sure.
Knowing what had gone on at the Girl Scout camp.
No, I'm not denying that. I agree with you there. But I think that there might have been a little bit different attitude because they were boys.
Yeah.
Possibly. It was the 70s.
Right. Well, right. And obviously there was some difference in attitude because the camp stayed open.
Yeah, right. There was something going on.
I don't even know if there was a consideration to closing the Boy Scout camp.
Well, do you think if that was a girls' camp 3 miles down, it would have been closed?
Yes.
You do?
Sure.
Okay. That's strange. Well, unless they thought, well, this murderer is after girls, but that's a big assumption to make and take your child's risk.
It is.
Risk your child's life for.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway. Only 13 people picked up their boy, and some security was added, but nothing else was really changed there. Now, a special telephone hotline was set up by police, hoping that someone who knew the killer would call in, or that the killer would call and make a confession. There was this belief that someone with that kind of brutality might feel guilty and decide to call and confess.
Okay, I'm not sure how they would figure that, but whatever they think might work.
It was a psychological theory at the time.
Well, it didn't work because nobody called in to
confess.
Nobody
called in, nope. Now, a little bit about the history of Camp Scott.
Okay.
Now, the 410-acre camp was named in honor of Florence and H.J. Scott, who were Tulsa Girl Scout and Boy Scout volunteers. They donated 24 acres to the camp. And the Girl Scout Council, through the years, used money raised from the sale of Girl Scout cookies to buy additional land. Now, from 1928 to 1977, over 12,000 girls attended Camp Scott, and the camp was arranged in 12 campsites. So there were 12 sites.
Yeah, not 8.
No. Now, Jean Leroy Hart soon became the primary suspect in these murders. He had been at large since 1973, after escaping from the Mays County Jail. He had been convicted of kidnapping and raping 2 pregnant women. So he was a Cherokee, and he was raised about only 1 mile away from the location of Camp Scott. Now, crime scene materials were found in a cave near the camp. Tape, plastic from a garage bag, similar to that wrapped around the flashlight they found next to the girls. 2 photos of women, eyeglasses, and a newspaper were found. And this was about 10 days after the murder occurred.
So they identified the women in the photos after they appeared in the paper. A prison guard had taken the photos at a wedding, and Jean Leroy Hart had developed the photos when he was serving prison time for kidnapping and rape convictions back in 1966. So he kept some souvenirs.
Creepy, huh?
Yes.
So what was he doing with those pictures? We don't want to know.
We don't know.
Okay.
Hart had been paroled in 1969. Soon after his release, he was tried for 4 Tulsa burglaries and sentenced to 50 years. In 1973, Hart was moved to the Mays County Jail to make an appearance in court. He escaped from there with another inmate and had been eluding the police ever since. So, like you said, 4 years on the run.
That's amazing to me. I didn't think people got away with that. Although this was back in the 70s, maybe it was more common then.
It was, plus he had help.
Yes, he did.
And people hiding him.
Right. and possibly the shape-shifting, which we'll get to later.
We will. The manhunt for Jean Hart began on June 23rd, so we're 10 days after the killings.
Right.
He was captured on April 6th, 1978, so he managed to go another 9-10 months without being captured.
He did.
State investigators found him living in a remote cabin in Cookson Hills of Cherokee County, 50 miles from Camp Scott. This was the home of a Cherokee medicine man, Sam Pidgeon Jr. Mm-hmm. So there are stories out there.
There sure are, and we're going to mention them.
About Sam, the medicine man. One is that he put a curse on the tracking dogs who were brought in for the search on Camp Scott.
That's right. Now, the Rottweiler named Butz died from heat stroke, and the German Shepherd named Harris ran into the street and was killed by a car. So 2 out of 3 of these tracking dogs died within a week of the murders and the curse. So is this just a coincidence, or is this a curse from the medicine man? I mean, that's something we can make up our own minds about. Now, after Hart was captured, he was returned to McAlester, Oklahoma State Penitentiary, where he had been serving a prison term prior to his 1973 escape. Now, Hart's trial began in March of 1979, and it was in the Mays County Courthouse. He pled not guilty to the triple murder. The jury consisted of 6 men and 6 women. The courthouse was full every day. The parents of the murdered girls came and sat in on the trial every day as well. Now, during the trial, photos of the murder scene and photographic slides of the victims' mutilated bodies were viewed by the jurors, although certain photos were eliminated due to graphic content that was determined by the judge to be overwhelming for the jurors to view. So this was a brutal crime. Let's just make that clear. This was a horrible, violent crime.
Extremely. Dr. Neil Hoffman, who is the Tulsa County medical examiner, told the jury that all 3 of the girls had been beaten, possibly with the head of a camp axe. Denise Milner died of strangulation. Michelle and Lori died from the trauma to their heads. Hoffman described the condition of their bound and mutilated bodies and told the jurors that all 3 had been sexually assaulted. So, as you said, a horrific crime.
So that makes me think it was more than one person.
I think there had to be more than one person.
I mean, I guess it could be some maniac grabs all 3 and assaults them separately. I don't think a man could grab all 3 and carry them off together at once.
No.
I mean, they're not babies. They're 8 or 9, 10 years old.
Maybe you could say that one person could get in and beat them all in the heads so they were either dead or unconscious and then take them out one at a time.
Right. But one of them wasn't unconscious when she left there, they said. Two of them were.
One was strangled.
Yeah, one was walked out.
So it would just seem to me that there'd be noise, screams.
Yeah, but it was isolated.
Yeah.
It was very woodsy.
It was still in a group.
And some people did hear screams.
Right. You're right. That would discount it. Go back to bed. You're hearing things.
Well, and that's not unusual. I really can't blame the counselors for that. When kids are away at camp like that, they get spooked. They get up, they hear things, whether they're there or not.
Particularly when it's so black out.
Yeah, and it's their first night there.
Yeah.
So I really don't blame the counselors for poo-pooing.
No, I don't either.
That kind of stuff.
But getting back to the original point, I think that there was probably more than one person.
Could be. I could see that possibility. Hmm. He did escape prison for someone.
Right.
Which I wasn't able to find out who that was or if he could have been involved.
Yeah, or if he'd ever been recaptured.
Sure.
Was he still on the run with
Hart? I wasn't able to find that. If anybody knows, they can write in and let us know.
So Ann Reed, who is the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation technician, testified that microscopic examination of hair found on Denise and in the victim's tent showed identical characteristics to hair samples taken from Jean Hart.
Right. So this is before DNA.
Correct.
Right. So this is hair sampling that they did, which didn't eliminate people like stuff we have now does, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Basically, you can look at the hairs under a microscope and say they're identical.
Yeah.
Or similar. Or dissimilar.
Right.
But that's it.
Yeah, so that wasn't super helpful.
And even today, you can't get DNA unless you get the hair root, the bulb.
True, yeah.
So digressing. Two chemists testified that the hair taken from Gene Hart failed to positively link him to the murders. They said the hair samples were similar, but not similar enough to point to a particular person.
Sure, they didn't have the ability to do that.
And Hart and the victims all shared the same blood type,
mm-hmm.
which in the 70s, that's about as far as you could go. According to a 2009 interview with former Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation chemist, the laboratory biological individualization capabilities at the time were almost non-existent. So, yeah, I mean, but that's no different from any laboratory in the 70s.
Right.
You didn't have much to go on.
Now, I know that you looked into forensics of the 1970s, and can you tell us a little bit about how things were and how we've progressed or whatever you want to share?
If you want, I can go through a whole bunch of stuff.
Sure.
All right.
I think our listeners like to learn as much as possible. Just keep it entertaining. That's the only pressure you have.
Okay. I'll try. So this will be a brief history of DNA testing.
Okay.
Okay? Because you're going to talk about DNA later.
Yes.
In this case.
That they tried to do later on. Yep.
So in 1977, when these killings occurred, forensic analysis consisted primarily of fingerprints, blood typing, microscopic studies. Not much to go on. So you look for fingerprints there on the neck of the child who's been strangled, you might have a case.
Okay. Right?
That type of thing.
Is it hard to get fingerprints off of skin, though?
Not terribly.
No? Okay. No. I would.
There's something you can spray.
Okay.
Or there was.
Yeah, fingerprints were big for a long time. I mean, when did those, do you know when those were started? Or did you not go back that far?
I didn't go back that far.
Okay, because that was it for a long time, was the fingerprints.
Early 20th century.
But, you know, before computers, though, not that long ago, they had to look at each fingerprint, maybe even in the 70s.
Right.
They didn't have, they couldn't go in the computer and scan the fingerprints.
No, you had to compare them.
Which was a lot of work, very tedious work.
So the beginnings of DNA techniques started in the early to mid 80s. Dr. Alec Jeffries, who is a British geneticist, developed the techniques for DNA fingerprinting and DNA profiling. So basically what he was able to do was to look at DNA sequences, not the total DNA of a person, but fragments of DNA. And he could look at those and compare with DNA that might be found on a victim. So first application of his studies was in the UK. In 1986, this followed a series of rapes. Jeffries did DNA analysis on the prime suspect, which, surprise, surprise, exonerated him.
Makes you wonder how many people were falsely convicted. Although, you know, we've discovered a lot with DNA now, so.
We have. So, but here's the interesting part. The police conducted a genetic dragnet by collecting blood samples from 4,000 men.
Wow.
In the area. And they're able to match one of the samples with semen from the victims.
Okay.
So this is the first successful.
And what year was that?
1986.
Okay.
Then the first case in the U.S. took place in Florida in 1987, again during a rape case. So the early DNA testing is analogous to the Model T Ford.
Okay. You know, how is that?
It's the first.
Yeah.
It's not very good. But it's the first.
Right.
So the early testing was pretty much supplanted in the 90s by the invention of the polymerase chain reaction. This is cool.
Okay.
Doctor won the Nobel Prize for these studies.
Mm-hmm.
So PCR, polymerase chain reaction, mimics the cell's ability to replicate DNA, which allows scientists to simply take small samples of DNA and copy it a millionfold.
Wow.
So they look at it as a molecular Xerox machine.
That is very cool.
Isn't it?
Yep.
So, and they did more research or additional research. They were able to identify even smaller fragments of DNA, some only a few base pairs long, which coupled with the PCR has now become the foundation of DNA technology.
Amazing.
So you can take DNA that's broken up even as small as 4 or 5 base pairs. Replicate them and get a DNA profile.
That's amazing.
It's pretty cool.
It's a great accomplishment.
It is. Now, I'll say one final thing, then I'll shut up. the National DNA Database known as the Combined DNA Index System, CODIS, which
we've talked about
many times, began as a 14-state pilot study in 1990. Today, all 50 states participate in the CODIS program, which is comprised of two main DNA indices. One is a forensic index that contains DNA profiles developed from crime scene-related evidence, and the other index is a convicted offender index. So if you are arrested for a felony, you're going to have your DNA in the database.
Which is a great thing, because then if you commit another crime, they'll be able to find you right away.
Right.
So that's important.
It is.
So back to where we are at this crime, they could do fingerprints. They could say the hair could be his.
Yep.
That's about it.
That's about it.
Okay.
And we already mentioned that Hart and the victims all had the same blood type.
Yeah.
So that didn't help any.
So that didn't help. Plus, even if you figure out the blood type, it only says it's his blood type. It's not going to narrow you down anything like DNA does.
Right. I mean,
it's going to say one out of five people have that blood type.
Yeah. If it's his blood type, you can say, you know, one out of two people have it.
Yeah, that's not that helpful.
Or one out of 100. I mean, it doesn't narrow it down much.
No.
DNA narrows it down to the millions and billions.
Yeah, right.
So.
Very specific.
It sure is.
So another young Girl Scout, Kim Lewis, testified on the night of the murders that she and a counselor and other girls came upon a man in the dark with a flashlight, like the one that was found in the girls' cabin. The girl testified that the man was white and he was over 6 feet tall. So the jurors were taken to Camp Scott so they could see where events occurred. And some jurors would later say that the visit to the camp convinced them that one man alone could not have committed these crimes. So that's like what you're saying, that it just doesn't seem like one person could have done that.
Yeah. I mean, just from reading the stuff I read, it didn't sound like a single person job.
Yeah, it doesn't really.
And if the witnesses saw this person walking around with a flashlight the night of the murders, and I'm figuring the flashlight was like the one that was found that had tape over it, so it had only a peephole.
Yeah, we don't know if it was the same one, but yeah.
Yeah, but this was a Caucasian over 6 feet tall.
Right.
Which doesn't match Hart.
Doesn't, no. Now, the jurors were taken to Camp Scott to see where it occurred, and they decided that it was probably more than one man, right? And the defense put on evidence that another person had committed the murders. So Joyce Payne and her son testified that a man named Bill Stevens, age 23, had come to their home on the morning that the murdered girls were found. And Mrs. Payne claimed that the flashlight recovered at the crime scene was the same one she'd loaned to Bill Stevens 1 month before the murders. She also said he had scratches on his arms and his neck, and he had red stains on his boots. Now, Bill Stevens was in a Kansas prison for other crimes at the time of Hart's trial. So Mrs. Dean Boyd, who worked in a cafe in Choctaw, Oklahoma, 15 miles from Camp Scott, testified that on June 13th, between 5 a.m. and 6 a.m., a man came into the cafe acting agitated. Mrs. Boyd didn't identify him as Gene Hart, but said he looked like Bill Stevens. But authorities had already taken hair, blood, and sperm samples from Stevens, so he'd already been eliminated as a suspect. So that wasn't helpful at all. Because you could eliminate him. He didn't have the same blood type, and the hair wouldn't have matched him.
Okay.
Although I guess he could have been an accomplice that just didn't leave any traces. That's another thing.
I mean, the fact that his hair didn't match wouldn't bother me as much.
No.
But
he could probably do it without leaving hair or blood.
Yeah.
But what about the sperm?
The semen.
If he was a rapist, he should have left the sperm.
Right. So they did studies that cleared him.
They felt that he was cleared. Now, after a month-long trial, Gene Hart was acquitted. And the investigation wasn't renewed because the state still believed that Hart was the killer. Now, Hart was returned to the state penitentiary, though, because he had to continue his earlier prison term on the other unrelated crimes.
Right. And he had escaped, so he had to go back.
Right, of course. And I imagine they added time for escaping.
Probably.
So let's just take a moment here before we get too deeply into it to talk about our sponsor, HelloFresh. Because HelloFresh is a meal kit delivery service that makes cooking more fun so you can focus on the whole experience, not just the final result. HelloFresh uses the freshest ingredients, measures them to the exact quantity you need, and delivers it all to your doorstep. So we had, the other night we had HelloFresh, we had harissa sweet potato pita pockets. It's a lot of peas.
Yeah,
harissa sweet potato pita pockets.
Say that fast three times in a row.
I can't, but they were delicious.
They were. And this is another thing that I found I like about HelloFresh.
Yeah.
They come up with some food combinations that I would never think of in a million years.
Yeah, so you're making it, you're not quite sure what you think of it, but then it turned out being really yummy.
It was fantastic, but I looked at the ingredients and I'm thinking, So it's just briefly, you roast the sweet potatoes, slice them up, and then you make a dill cucumber salad, and you slice up a cucumber, and you make a harissa mayonnaise. So harissa is a Middle Eastern spice. It's kind of hot. So you put the mayonnaise in the pita pocket, add the sweet potatoes, add the avocado, add the cucumber slices, salad, and eat it. Now, who would think of that combination?
And it's perfect for spring, summer, right? They're getting their nice summer recipes out now.
It was an amazing meal.
It was delicious, yeah. So for $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, visit HelloFresh.com and enter our promo code TCB30. Say HelloFresh and say...
Hello, family.
So in May of 1979, the families of the murdered girls sued for $3.5 million, and the civil trial didn't begin until March of 1985. Attorneys for the families argued that the Magic Empire Girl Scout Council operated the camp without providing adequate security. They argued that Camp Scott's staff had remained relaxed about security at the heavily wooded campground, despite intrusions and thefts that had occurred over the years. Now, the number of incidents on the campground, they said, should have been a warning for the need for more security there. Also, camp officials should have reported the incidents to the authorities when they occurred. Once, a man was found inside a camper's tent, and then on another occasion, someone tried to break into a cabin as the girls screamed for help inside. Later on, a camper discovered the note warning that the three girls would be killed. Attorneys for the Girl Scout Council argued that many of the sightings were local sportsmen or camp staff members. Also, many incidents were Girl Scout pranks or thought to be. Camp officials had believed that contacting local authorities seemed unnecessary when it happened back in 1977. Now, Glenn Pete Weaver, who was the Mays County Sheriff in 1977, said that Jean had been seen at his mother's house, which was just a mile from the camp.
Yeah. Well, and this goes back to my earlier question. I mean, how commonplace were these incidents that occurred in the camp?
Pretty commonplace from what I've read.
So.
At least at that camp.
I guess I can see discounting them.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Or maybe they were so frequent they should have done something about it.
Well, that was my question. And we don't know. I mean, were similar events recorded at the Boy Scout camp down the street?
Not that I read about. No. Yeah. So, hasn't been mentioned. It wasn't mentioned in the court case.
Yep. Again, 2020 hindsight.
Well, that's true. But hopefully we can learn from it, and that's the point.
Right. So besides being sighted at his mother's house, which is only a short distance from camp, two other occasions in 1976 and 1977, Jean Hart had been sighted near the camp.
Well, yeah, but he was being, I guess it was being covered up by people in his community because he was well loved.
Right. And they didn't think
he was. People were hiding him.
Sure. But he'd been seen around the camp.
Yes, people had reported seeing
him. On more than one occasion.
Sure.
On June 12th, 1977, the day of the girls' arrival at the camp, Weaver was investigating a burglary at a nearby farmhouse. Weaver only realized that Camp Scott had no security after the murders had already occurred. Tents were unlighted in heavily wooded and overgrown location. The tent the girls were murdered in was not visible from the camp counselor's tent.
No. But don't you think maybe the police should have gone over and said, hey, what do you have for security, and been involved in this?
Well, yeah.
He didn't know. Well, why didn't he know? He should know what's going on there.
This camp had been in operation for 50 years, right? It started in the late 1920s.
Well, I don't see what that has to do with anything.
Complacency.
Okay.
Nothing's ever happened, so we don't need to change anything.
Yeah, I see that. I don't agree with it, but I see how it happens.
Yeah. But I can see that.
Sure.
It's been there forever. There's never been an incident of any kind.
Right.
So several people testified about multiple thefts, burglaries, and intrusions at Camp Scott over the years. So there's been stuff going on.
Quite a bit.
Former campers and staff had never been trained on what to do if an intruder entered the camp. Constance Cunningham, who's a former head counselor, testified that in a 1971 summer camp session, she had borrowed a gun and stayed in a tent which had been entered the night before by a strange man. During her 2 years as a counselor, she had seen several intruders at the camp. We're getting back to, geez, there might be a history here.
Yeah, and it kills me. The thought process of the people back then was, get a gun, protect yourself.
Yeah.
Nobody went to the police.
The main gate was locked at night.
Sure.
But that doesn't keep people out.
I don't think it had barbed wire or anything.
No.
No.
So you just maybe couldn't get in that way, but there were plenty of other entry points.
Of course, it's the woods. It's 400 acres of woods.
Yeah.
I mean, there could be people living in there. Who knows?
Right.
So Cunningham, she talked to the camp director, Helen Gray, back in 1970, about campers who'd come to her about hearing heavy breathing outside their tents at night. How creepy is that? Now, Gray had brushed it off because nothing had happened, like you said. Well, nothing bad's ever happened, so la-di-da.
Yep.
Now, the next year, before summer sessions began, Gray met with counselors who knew about the earlier incidents, and she actually cautioned them not to say anything to the new counselors because we don't want to upset them.
No, we don't.
So they're keeping it secret.
But just one interjection. This is in the early 70s.
Yes.
So Hart's nowhere around there then.
No.
He's in jail somewhere else. He didn't.
Yeah, because he escaped in 73.
73.
Well, yeah. And I think we have a good point here that Hart's not the only problem here.
Right.
Yeah. And even if it was just peeping Toms and things, still, you don't want that going on.
Oh.
No.
Not with your prepubescent Girl Scout.
No, it's horrible. So as the intrusions did continue, Cunningham became more frightened, but camp directors pushed her concerns aside. And Gray said that it had happened past summers and no harm had been done, so don't worry about it.
Yeah, they're okay.
So complacency.
They just wander around and don't bother anybody.
Now, in March 1981, a deposition from a former Camp Scott counselor, Michelle Hoffman, testified about a threatening note found less than 2 months before the murders. So during this pre-summer prep session, one of Hoffman's fellow counselors found her belongings rummaged through. A box of donuts had been stolen, but later she found the empty donut box and the note was inside, and it had printed block capital letters, and the note read, "We are on a mission to kill 3 girls in tent 1. And it was signed "The Killer." Hoffman said she was kind of frightened at first, but then they decided it was a joke. And she said the counselors gave the note to Barbara Olmstead, the coordinator of the spring camporee session at Camp Scott, and Barbara threw it away. So Girl Scout officials testified that, despite recommendations from accreditation groups, there was no security plan in place when the 3 girls were murdered. Some witnesses testified that when they reported problems at camp to the Locust Grove police, the officers claimed that it was outside of their jurisdiction. Now, former Mays County Sheriff Pete Weaver testified that the camp fell under the jurisdiction of the sheriff's office. But some camp directors said that the Locust Grove officers had advised them not to call the sheriff's office if they needed police help. So I'm just wondering, who were they supposed to call? What were they supposed to do? Nobody had thought this through. I mean, we're not only talking about murder, we're talking about what if someone's seriously injured?
Yeah.
You know,
not even.
Or if someone goes missing.
This crime.
Yeah. It's not just this crime. It's many crimes could have happened.
Yep. And we don't know what the chain of command is.
No, you've got the Locust Grove police saying, it's not us, but don't call the sheriff. So that leaves them very little. What do they do?
Yeah. Well, I guess they have to call the sheriff.
Well, they were told not to.
Yeah. Well.
And these counselors are young people. They're not the most savvy. If policeman tells a 19, 20-year-old person.
Well, when the murders were discovered, they called the sheriff.
Well, yeah, 3 bodies.
Yeah.
Then of course they are.
Okay.
But the warning signs, the other things that happened, they didn't report.
Right.
And I think with the 3 bodies, all bets are off, and you're going to call whoever you need to.
Sure.
Right.
So that's how I'd look at it. I mean, yeah, the Locust Grove police said it's not our jurisdiction and don't bother calling the sheriff, but something bad happens, I'm going to call the sheriff.
Well, I understand, but they should have had a plan of who they should call.
Of course they should have.
Yeah, that's all I'm saying.
So there's a Tulsa security expert who testified in this civil suit. He felt several basic security steps would have deterred the killer. One of the problems he identified was that the tents were spread so far apart that only two of them were visible from the counselor's tent. He also said that the camp kitchen in the center obscured the view of campers' tents from the counselor's tent. The most obscured tent was the one where the three murdered girls slept. So it's in a crummy location to begin with, and it's the crummiest of the crummy location.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, it's pretty easy to say that that's why it was picked.
Yes. Elementary.
It was chosen because of its poor security factors, yeah.
On March 27th, 1985, jurors deliberated for 5 hours before finding that the murders of the three girls at Camp Scott were not the result of negligence on the part of the Girl Scout Council or its insurance company. Families appealed the decision and it was upheld. So after these murders in 1977, the Girl Scout Council in Tulsa didn't have overnight summer camp again until 1981. And it wasn't at Camp Scott, was it?
No, it was in a different area.
Camp Scott's never been used again as a camp.
As a Girl Scout
camp. As a Girl Scout camp. It's been sold off. At the new camp, scouts stayed in raised cabins instead of tents, and there is a large fence with barbed wire surrounding the camp. So we've gone to taking our security a little more seriously.
Which is good, but I was a little surprised that they didn't hold the council or the insurance company responsible.
I am too.
Yeah.
I mean, it seemed like there was enough testimony that things had been going on that had been shoved under the rug or ignored, that there was some fault on the part of the council.
Well, I wonder if maybe the information never got high enough to hold them accountable, because it seemed like it was just the counselors and people that knew and no one actually reported it to the council.
Good point. That's probably what happened.
I think that's where the breakdown was.
It stopped.
Yeah. Now, there was professional security on site and plans set up for medical and law enforcement personnel in the new camps, and that allowed for quick response when needed. Staff members were screened and attended mandatory training, which included health, safety, and emergency procedures. So that seems sensible to me.
Yes, it does.
Now, in July 1989, the FBI lab used new genetic testing called DNA fingerprinting. And the new test analyzed blood and semen based on no two people sharing the same genetic makeup, and it took 8 weeks. Evidence used included a pillowcase stained with seminal fluid and a known blood sample from Jean Hart. Now, Jean Hart had died back in 1979 from a heart attack in the prison yard. And in August 1989, the results came back inconclusive. So the test done showed that 1 in 7,700 American Indians would match these body fluid samples, but that's as specific as it could get. So how specific do you find that to be? 1 in 7,700 American Indians.
Obviously, it's way more specific than simple blood typing.
Sure.
But it's still not quite
not
where it should be.
Because there's a pretty large Native American community.
Right. But at the same time, it didn't exonerate Hart. Didn't say there was no match.
Not at all. No. But they weren't able to actually, you know, decide that it was definitely him, which is what they wanted to do.
Sure.
And then in 2002, more DNA tests were done to extract DNA from the same pillowcase that they'd used in the 1989 test. So this would be what you were talking about, where they take a small piece of DNA.
PCR analysis.
Yeah, that's what they tried. But these samples were just too deteriorated and couldn't be used. They couldn't get a good sample.
They were too degraded.
Which, I wonder, were they not storing them correctly? Is there a better way to store them now?
Yeah, there is. But back then, they were just stuck in a box.
Yeah. Well, in 2007, an independent lab used by the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation compared DNA recovered from one of the victims with a known semen sample from Jean Leroy Hart. The lab used up an entire piece of evidence that was destroyed by the testing, and again, the sexual assault samples were too deteriorated to get a DNA profile. There were some events worth mentioning that happened after the murders of the three girls I'd just like to talk about for a second. So one was that on June 29th, 1977, so that's like 2 weeks after the murders?
Yeah, just about 2 weeks.
A 15-year-old Girl Scout was dragged from her tent in Sarasota, Florida. A large man ripped open the back of the tent and grabbed her before dawn, and her tent mates screamed and woke the camp leader.
And the camp leader called the sheriff. Sheriff deputies found a trail of boot prints and bare feet leading to the old plant nursery. The next day, the girl telephoned her father to say she was safe.
So thank God for that. I mean, the odds of her being alive to me would seem slim.
By July 3rd, she was returned unharmed, and her abductor was taken into custody. So that turned out okay.
Yeah, we don't know what happened to her during that time period, but she did survive.
At the end of July 1977, a pair of tennis shoes appeared at Camp Scott with the handwritten name of Denise Milner inside the shoes. The shoes were found on the front steps of the building formerly used as the command post by law enforcement after the murders. Tracking dogs were brought in, but they lost the trail. Investigators tied thread between the trees near the murder scene, which were broken. Footprints were also found. The shoes were taken to the crime lab for testing, but the Milner family said they were not their daughter's shoes.
So that was probably a hoax.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe a taunt.
Yeah, maybe.
You know?
It could have just been kids actually doing that,
sure.
But who knows? Now, in 1980, the first Friday the 13th movie was released in theaters, and this seemed to be the beginning of contemporary urban legend of these summer camp-type murders. Which I feel like really stemmed from a lot of the fear that people had after these murders. Looking at them and a way that people deal with them is to kind of make it part of the culture and the media. The Friday the 13th franchise had 12 movies released between 1980 and 2009, and there was also a TV series that had three seasons from 1987 to 1990. Now, I saw the first three, and the third one was that 3D one. Did you see that? You see them?
I've seen the first one or two. And I didn't see the 3D one because I don't see 3D.
That's right. You can't see 3D. But the 3D, it seemed really exciting at the time. You know, you're young, you think, wow, that's cool. There were sharp weapons and body parts flying towards the audience, so that was kind of cool. Now, during the search for Jean Hart, some people in the Cherokee community believed that Hart was a skinwalker. And this is a witch who can turn into an animal. So this type of shape-shifting is considered an innate ability, and believers are really hesitant to talk about it or even look into the eyes of a person who's thought to have these powers.
Well, yeah, you could get hurt.
Right. Now, Hart's shape-shifting abilities have been suggested as the method of his escape from jail. His ability to elude police for such a long time, and maybe even how he fled the scene of the girls' murders. Now, you're giving me that look, but bear with me here. It was said by some of the searchers at the crime scene that the tracking dogs followed a scent from the camp to a clearing where all three stopped and started looking up as if the perpetrator had just flown away or ascended.
Okay.
Now...
You got to do more to convince me.
Well, then there was the curse put on the dogs, followed by two of them dying days later. Now, what kind of trained tracker dog runs into traffic?
Well, what I was reading was that he wasn't loose running into traffic. He was back home in Philadelphia or wherever he came from.
Oh.
And was being walked and got into traffic.
With a person?
With a person.
And the person got hit too?
No.
He was ahead of the person.
Just the dog.
Okay. Still... cursed and dies soon after.
Yeah. And the other one died of heat exhaustion.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not like they all just kind of keeled over dead.
No, but that's not how curses work. Haven't you heard of, watched any movies with curses? Like Thinner, the Stephen King, where he's cursed thinner. It takes months for him to get real thin.
And your point is?
So a curse doesn't just, it's not like a spell that just happens. A curse is something that could take time and kind of fits into things. It's not like a drastic thing that is unexplainable. It kind of happens like, so someone could think, well, that's just a normal course of events.
Okay.
And it's not directly linked to the curse. Anyway, if Jean Hart did have this supernatural ability to change himself, many say he may have become an owl because owls are native to that area. So now we have a second True Crime Brewery owl theory.
We do.
The Jean Hart owl theory.
Yes.
Yes.
Which... I'm not buying.
All right, so you like the Michael Peterson one better.
I like the Michael Peterson owl theory way better.
I don't know. I mean, I don't generally believe in the supernatural, but when you get to the Native American stuff, there's something to it, maybe.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, how about it's just the fact that he was well-liked in his community and people took active steps to make sure he wasn't apprehended?
Oh, yeah. I totally think that's how he stayed away from police.
Okay. And there's caves and stuff in the area. I mean, there's plenty of hideouts.
Yeah, he may have just been really good at nature and hiding out, and he had a lot of help.
Yeah.
But that's not as romantic as the owl theory.
I know.
It's kind of boring.
And one other thing would be maybe he wasn't being looked for that much.
Really? So you think the police were giving him a break?
Well, he was in jail for what? Robbery or something?
No, he raped two pregnant women.
No, he had been paroled from that.
Yeah, but still.
He was serving time for robbery.
Yes, but still, he had been convicted of raping women.
Yeah, but
he was on parole for that.
Right.
So he violated parole as well as broke the law with robbery or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's your point with that?
My point is that he was serving time for robbery, and that probably was low enough on the radar.
But he's a known rapist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he hasn't committed other rapes that they know of.
Okay.
And he wasn't in jail at that point for rape. He was
no, but he's a rapist regardless of what he's in jail for.
I'm just saying that maybe they weren't looking for him that hard.
Well, no. I mean, we saw interviews with people from the community, and they just thought he was a great guy, that he never would have done this. So you're right about that.
Yep.
I don't know about police, but people in the community definitely thought he was wonderful.
Oh, there's no question of that.
So he was a football star.
I think that they were very active in helping him elude capture.
Okay. You ready to go to feedback?
Let's do feedback.
All right. Little music, and we'll have the feedback ready.
Okay.
Welcome to feedback.
So you want me to go first, huh?
I do.
Okay. I have an email from Hillary regarding two cases. One is about Au Pairs from the Shaken Baby episode, and the other is about Away From Home, which is the disappearance of Timothy Pitson. So Hillary says, I recently heard you read some feedback from a listener regarding the definition of an au pair. I employed au pairs here in the Philadelphia area for about 10 years, from 2000 to 2010. I hired them through a reputable agency called Au Pair Care. The regulations at the time stated that an au pair may work up to 45 hours per week, must have at least one full day off per week, is entitled to paid two-week vacation, and must attend classes, perhaps 10 credits per year. I forget the educational requirement. Anyway, the work they do must be childcare related, caring directly for the kids, feeding them, cooking for them, cleaning up after them, doing their laundry, etc. If the family only needs 45 hours of childcare per week, it is completely reasonable to have an au pair. No, it isn't the same as a nanny. Nannies cost more because they have more education and qualifications. But I think your listener was mistaken about what an au pair can reasonably be expected to do under the U.S. regulations governing the au pair visa, which is what we thought.
Right, right.
But the other comment she has is related, or did you want to talk about au pairs first?
No, I mean, I think that's pretty much what I thought, is that they can do that much work.
Right.
And it's determined by whom? Who are the rules determined by?
The au pair agency.
Yeah. So I thought that there was a lack of communication between the au pair service, the Epins, and Louise Woodward.
I think so.
There was a misunderstanding, perhaps, of how much time she should have spent.
True. But I think that the parents made it clear what they expected of Louise.
They did, and if that wasn't good with her, she should have talked to the service and maybe worked somewhere else or made some kind of compromise, because she knew that these were both career people who were working long hours. They were both, you know, fairly new physicians who were working a lot of hours in the hospital. So
I
think it was pretty clear that it was going to be heavy childcare.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I do too.
Okay.
Okay. The other comment I have is regarding the episode Away from Home. You talked about the mother, Amy, possibly loving her son so much she killed him to keep him with her. As a veterinarian, it is not rare to be asked by a client to euthanize his or her pet as a client's own death approaches, because Fluffy will die without me, or no one can take as good care of Fluffy as I do. When the pet is elderly, ill, or otherwise unfit for rehoming, this is not a huge issue. But sometimes the pet is young and healthy and behaviorally sound. This is a huge ethical dilemma for me and for my colleagues. My point is, lots of otherwise seemingly normal people do have this type of idea. Well, we see that a lot.
So what do you think of that? I have very strong opinions, so I'm going to let you go first.
Okay. I think what she says is spot on, that people are approaching the end of life and they want their pets to go with them.
Yeah, but is it okay with you?
It's okay with me, with the stipulation that the pet is elderly, ill, or otherwise unfit for rehoming.
Well, I think we're all on board with that, but what about the person who's dying and says, you know, Spike can't live without me, even though Spike's doing just fine on his own?
Yeah, well, I would, not knowing what the ethics of the veterinary profession is, but from my standpoint, I would really work hard to place that pet in a home.
Yeah.
Rather than kill an otherwise healthy pet.
Well, right. And I'm not going to be specific, but I do have a relative who's a veterinarian, and people have gone to this relative and wanted a dog put to sleep. And I believe that this relative has found the dog a home, even though the person believes that the dog was put to sleep, because it doesn't seem ethical to do that. But then it's not really ethical to lie to the person either.
Yeah,
so it is a tough spot.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah.
I suppose. And how do these people, these pet owners, know how quickly they're going
to
die?
I don't know. To me, it's totally selfish. It's a no-brainer to me. That's selfish.
Yeah.
Yeah, you find a good home for your dog or your cat, your pet, whoever your pet is.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that.
Unless they're suffering in some way. It has nothing to do with you. And that's kind of goes the same to Timothy and his mother. If she killed Timothy because she was suicidal, that's totally selfish. And I'm not okay with that, of course.
Well, and we think she did kill him. I mean, I know the story was that she gave him to people.
Well, it's not proven that she killed him, but he hasn't been seen, and it seems likely that she killed him.
Yes.
She was a disturbed person.
She was very depressed. Very depressed.
But I don't have any sympathy thinking that that they love them so much that they want them to die with him. That's not love.
No, it's not.
That's not love at all in my eyes.
Mm-mm.
It's selfishness. Self-importance, almost.
Right.
Don't like it.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I have a comment from Boom Boom on YouTube, and this is regarding the buried secrets, the victims of Todd Kohlhepp. So there was a murder in that episode where some of the blood was mixed up between two of the victims in a mass shooting. Remember that in the motorcycle shop?
Right.
They'd mixed up the blood of two people, and then they told the woman that her son wasn't her husband's son
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was a mess. So Boom Boom says, I think there should be an investigation on the department, lab, or names of those responsible for mislabeling the DNA samples of these victims. I seriously doubt that this is a simple mistake, and if not for the national attention this case has received, maybe they would have been able to hide such incompetence. If this is how they handle a high-profile case, it makes me wonder how well they are conducting forensics on crimes deemed low-profile. I've seen in the news that the sheriff stated he did not believe that foul play was involved in the disappearance of Kayla Brown and Charlie Carver. Hence, it took them 2 months to locate her, even though Kayla's cell phone had pinged from his property. And then it says SMH, exclamation point. I don't know what that stands for.
Me either. I probably should,
but I don't know. So
I'm not up to my acronyms.
Yeah, I don't know what that means. But anyway, I totally agree. This was, that incompetence is scary. And it should be looked into that it's not happening and it isn't repeated.
Yeah, I would agree.
That was really stupid.
But I'm not sure it was purposeful.
I'm not either. But I think it should be investigated to make sure.
definitely.
That people are doing their
jobs. Something like that happens. Yeah.
Right. And that's why it took so long to find that woman also could have been incompetence.
Yes.
So anywhere there's incompetence, I think we need to investigate.
We do.
So I would agree with that.
And I have another one, an email from Kelly, who has a suggestion. She has a case suggestion.
Oh, good.
Jacob Wetterling from Minnesota. This case wasn't solved for about 27 years. I remember when he went missing as I was a child about his age when it happened. I can tell you, growing up in Minnesota, this case changed everything for many children. Playing outside wasn't the same after this happened. Hovering parents, understandably so, went into overhaul immediately following his abduction. Fascinating case, and I love how well researched you two work each case. I would love to hear what you have to say about this one. We looked up Wetterling, Jacob. He disappeared in October of 1989. And his abduction remained a mystery for nearly 27 years.
Yeah, he was just recently found, his remains, right?
Last September, the FBI recovered human remains from a pasture in Minnesota, about 30 miles from the site of the abduction. The family eventually announced the remains were those of Jacob. The local law enforcement stated that confirmation of the identity had been obtained through dental records. So the location was revealed by Danny Heinrich, who is a longtime person of interest in the abduction of another boy in the nearby town of Cold Spring. So on October 6, 2016, shortly after they found his body and they made the identification, Heinrich confessed to kidnapping and murdering Jacob Wetterling, as well as abducting and assaulting Jared Sherrill.
Okay.
Well, it does sound like an interesting case.
Yeah, I think it's been done, but I think if there's enough in that time between when he went missing to when his body was found, if we can find enough research on what was going on, it could be interesting. So
yeah,
definitely look into it and see if we can make an episode out of that.
I would love to see how 27 years go by.
Right, and what his family was thinking and what was going on there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So thank you, Kelly.
Yeah, thank you, Kelly.
Good suggestion.
Yep. So I have an email from Lisa, and Lisa, we've talked back and forth about the Staircase series, and she was answering my question about Michael Peterson and the Gordon Lightfoot song, Sundown.
Oh, good.
I know you wanted to
hear. We got the answer.
We did.
Do we have the answer?
We do have the answer, and it makes me feel kind of shallow because she's very deep on it. She has a very deep feeling about what the song makes her think about Michael Peterson, and we were kind of just trying to read word for word in a very superficial way. So
yeah.
Let me just read what the main part of what she wrote.
Good.
So with regard to the Gordon Lightfoot song Sundown, when I listen to that song, I feel like it just captures what Michael Peterson was all about. To me, it describes the essence of him. The song is eerie and mysterious, just like the man and the crime itself. There is a public illusion of Michael Peterson, but who is he really? Beautiful wife, amazing kids, impressive lifestyle. These are the superficial layers. Bisexuality, lies, the need for attention, and his own secret world, the present but less obvious layers to Michael Peterson. He knows he needs to be seen to be that normal and successful guy, but there is that monster within, creeping around in the background, and coming to the surface when the need to get what he wants takes over. I'm not sure that any of us mere mortals could comprehend just what Michael Peterson's needs and drives are. They are just too complicated. All goodness and conformity on one side, lies and secrets on the other. So, to Lisa, she says, Sundown is the monster within. There is really no one who can tell us the tone of the personal relationship between Michael and Kathleen at the time of Kathleen's death, because there were no witnesses to the relationship in truth. So, as they say, no one knows what's going on behind closed doors. And who knows how much pain or drama Michael Peterson needs in his life in order to feel anything at all. So I thought that was pretty deep of her.
Oh, I got to tell you, I looked at the lyrics to that song.
Yeah.
And I don't come anywhere close to what she's reading into it.
Oh, well, now that I've read this, I see it. I see what she's saying, creeping around back stairs and kind of like the secret side of a person.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, she also added some more, which I thought was interesting. She said there's some questions she has as well. So one of the questions she asks is, what's going on with Patty? And we've brought that up. Appearing like a ghost in the background of so many of the scenes of Michael Peterson's trials and tribulations over this case. I have never seen a more dedicated ex-wife.
True.
I mean, I totally always wondered why she's so dedicated. So yeah, it was weird. They're divorced, but she flew from Germany and she sat through the trials.
Yeah.
So what do you think of her? She's an enigma.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe she has a similar illness to Mike.
Yeah.
And maybe there's some codependency there. I don't know.
So now you're buying into Michael Peterson having an illness. You don't think he's innocent.
I still think he's innocent.
Oh, okay. But maybe she has a need for drama in her life?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Because there certainly seems to be a need for drama in Michael's life.
Even though he's innocent?
Yeah.
Okay.
I can have both, can't I?
I guess so. And her next question is, why did Michael and Patty separate, and why did Michael take Martha and Margaret initially with him while the boys stayed with Patty? Did Patty have a problem with the girls?
Well, I've been mulling that for a long time.
You did ask that.
I don't know why he got custody.
Well,
you were talking about maybe there was an arrangement between the two families that if...
Well, there were when they got them as a couple, but what she's talking about is when Patty and Michael separated. Why did Michael take the girls?
I know.
That's weird.
I don't know.
I don't know either. That's a good question. As Michael Peterson has a military background, was he ever trained or did he gain experience in methods to kill, like how to create head injuries that would result in blood loss and death without causing fractures or covert evidence of how the injuries were inflicted? I know nothing about the training or experiences of Marines who went to Vietnam, but is this possible, given two women significant in his life had died this way? I think it was a coincidence.
I do, too. Plus, I don't think there's any amount of training that you can do that will allow you to inflict damage without skull fractures or evidence of trauma to the skull.
Right. So how did that happen?
How did
you think it was the owl with Kathleen? Do you think that the other one had a brain hemorrhage or an aneurysm?
Sure. Could have been.
Okay.
But I don't think there's a question of being beaten on the head with a blunt object that would be sufficient to cause all that blood and death without fracturing the skull.
Yeah, and I think that's what the person, who was the one that testified for the defense? Henry Lee. That's what he said.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, another question from Lisa. She puts so much thought into this. I really do appreciate it. How did a film crew arrive right on time to film the whole Michael Peterson ordeal? And who thought that filming everything was a good idea, given the circumstances of the death of his wife? I hope my husband would be far too grief-stricken to even entertain the idea if I'm ever brutally murdered in my home. Well, Lisa, if she was murdered in her home, he's the one that did it. So that cancels out the grief-stricken about the murder.
Right.
No one else could have murdered her.
Yeah.
If she was killed by an owl and a fall, you know. The only other thing I can think of is maybe by letting the film person in, there was some money to help with the defense. Or maybe the attorneys were more willing to do it for less money if they got to be in the film. Because it's an excellent film.
It is.
And the documentarian, he has done some great stuff before, too. So he's well known for doing good documentary work.
Yeah.
Can you think of anything else?
I think they were just kind of in the right place at the right time.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought they probably knew someone and who called them and said, you know, we're going to do this case. It's a great, for you. It'd be a great film. Come on over.
That's exactly what I said. The right place at the right time.
Okay. So they didn't just happen to arrive?
No.
No. That wouldn't make sense.
I don't think so.
No.
They were tipped.
And these things take a while, so they definitely had time to get that together.
Yeah. It's not like an arrest was made and the trial started.
Right. And then Lisa talks about the bisexuality thing. My daughter summed it up beautifully when she was in high school and everyone was coming out as bisexual. Her observation was that if you put yourself out there as bisexual, you just get more opportunities for sex with anyone willing and with a pulse. Was Michael Peterson a sex addict?
Well, sure, he could have been.
Right. But being a sex addict, that means you don't care who you're with if it's the same sex? I thought you had to have that in your, I don't know, DNA or whatever. You'd have to desire someone of the same sex regardless.
Right.
I mean, if you're a heterosexual sex addict, wouldn't you just want more women if you're a man?
Yeah.
I don't know.
But
maybe there are sex addicts that are just so addicted they don't care.
I can see that point.
Can you?
That if you're having sex with both men and women, that increases your chances for having sex.
Right. And you don't necessarily have to be a homosexual to do that. I mean, I know there are so many different levels,
yeah,
but...
I don't think I can speak to that.
No, I'm not sure about that. But it's certainly a possibility.
Yeah. But your other comment was, say you're a heterosexual sex addict.
Yeah.
You should be able to find plenty of people to have sex with.
Probably. And another thing is, was he really having much sex? Maybe when he was younger, but it seems like at the time of, you know, the years before Kathleen died, he wasn't going out and having sex with a lot of men. This one guy he was setting it up with, like, way ahead of time.
Yeah, but they never consummated.
No, he probably would have. But I'm just saying it's not like if he was a sex addict, he'd be doing it at least a couple times a week with somebody, you would think.
You would.
He can't be a sex addict and plan to have sex with someone 3 months from now.
No.
Which was kind of what he was doing.
Exactly.
I mean, he may have been doing some porn and masturbation that we don't know of, because there was stuff on his computer, I believe. I don't see any signs of him being a sex addict. There were no affairs, right?
Not that we know of.
Not that we heard about, and I believe it would have come out, because they were looking for dirt on him.
No kidding.
There was no one in the community he was sleeping with that we know of.
No.
So I kind of think, no, he probably wasn't a sex addict. And that's about it. That's all I got from Lisa, but thanks again, Lisa, and... I'm really impressed with your interpretation from Sundown. Good job.
Sounds
like. She comes up with great stuff.
Okay, one final one. A Facebook message from Jana. Hi, Jill and Dick. I was wondering if you guys would ever do a series of shows on Wisconsin killers. Sadly, we've had a couple, from serial killers like Jeffrey Dahmer and Ed Gein to innocent, in parentheses, Stephen Avery. I just think it would be a good series of stories to talk about. I could even try to talk to my brother-in-law about beers to suggest. She mentioned that her brother-in-law works at Carbon 4 Brewery, so
yeah,
that'd be good.
Yeah.
And then she also has a comment, what about doing a throwback series about serial killers in history like Jack the Ripper or Countess Elizabeth Bathory de Exed? I think that would be such a great twist on your show. Just a thought.
Yeah, I think we might do a throwback. I was thinking maybe something like Thanksgiving throwback. Like at Thanksgiving time, we'll do a real old one for fun or mix it up a little.
Yeah. I'd like to find maybe someone more obscure.
Yes.
Historical.
Absolutely.
But it'd be an interesting concept.
Yeah, I like that idea.
And we are planning on doing a Jeffrey Dahmer episode.
Well, I don't have it scheduled, but it's on my radar eventually.
I know. You said we were.
Yeah, we will.
Okay.
And then the one last comment I have is from Gina on YouTube, and it's a rather long one. It's about Darlie Routier, and we've had a few about her.
Yeah, she's a well-rehearsed or well-researched person.
Yeah. Gina says, this case has haunted me since it happened. My brother and his young sons lived in Dale Rock Subdivision in Rowlett at the time of the murders. I remember driving by the house after it happened and being terrified by it. I think there are some facts that you're missing. The sock in the alley. It was found over 75 yards away. It had the blood of both boys on it, but it did not contain any blood from Darlie. The timeline makes it impossible for that sock to have been planted. The scene staged, the call made, and the police arrive on the scene while Damon was still clinging to life. I think it would be very hard for her to have planted the sock and not leave one trace of blood from her house to the scene where the sock was found, and then back to the house again. Have you heard the theory that chloroform was used on the sock to initially knock out Darlie? And I haven't. Have you?
No.
Okay. There is documentation in the Baylor medical records that her mouth and gums were bruised with no explanation. It would make sense that she woke up to the attack if she had been knocked out with chloroform initially. It also alters memory. It would also make sense that the killer attacked the children first if she was already knocked out. Perhaps he put the sock over her mouth and knocked her out, and then had it on his person when he stabbed the boys, which would have resulted in only their blood being on the sock. It would make her illogical behavior, such as chasing behind him, make more sense if she'd been altered with the use of chloroform as well. It would also be undetectable, unless they tested for it immediately. Now, her injuries were pretty extensive, and her emotional trauma was indescribable, so I'm sure that by the time the paramedics arrived, she was not lucid. So if she was drugged, it would have looked much different than the state she was in when they arrived. They never tested the sock for chloroform, and my understanding is that it cannot be tested at this point. As for the fibers on the knife, there is a theory that the fibers are not conclusively linked to the screen. They could actually be from the fingerprint powder, which contains iron fragments and used to identify prints. Now, I'm not sure about this. Forensic Files episode that I watched seemed pretty sure about that.
Yes.
But that show's always pretty sure about the person's guilt.
You got to take a stance.
Right.
In Forensic Files.
Yeah. So that's interesting, though. I hadn't heard about that. The phone call was scrutinized because she stated that she had already touched the knife and maybe they could have gotten prints. Well, of course she said that. The 911 operator told her not to touch the knife. I don't think that she would have brought up the fact that she already touched it and they could have possibly gotten fingerprints if the operator had not told her not to touch it. Now, my memory, and I could be wrong, is that she said that before the 911 operator said anything. Do you remember the call?
I don't remember.
Okay. In my memory, she'd said, I already touched the knife, maybe you could have gotten fingerprints on her own before the 911 operator mentioned anything like that. So I'd have to re-listen to that. Now, anybody knows why someone would say not to touch it after they say it out loud. I don't think she was trying to cover up anything, and I've heard the phone call. She seemed to be in sheer panic. Bottom line is that I think there are just too many unanswered questions to put someone on death row. Now, that I kind of agree with. I can understand how many people think she did it, and I can also understand how people think she's innocent. Personally, I would not be convinced she's guilty, and certainly would not be able to convict her of the murders. The motive is weak and far-reaching. They got in the way of her lifestyle? That doesn't make any sense. That's true, but I would also like to throw in there that most murders don't make sense.
Well, I was just about to say, there's a senselessness to murder to begin with.
Absolutely. And people aren't thinking clearly if they think they're going to improve their life by murdering someone. It never works that way. Then she goes on to say, I think that it would take somebody with a history of mental illness that is severe and profound, poor treatment of her children, and most likely an abusive pattern of behavior with malignant narcissistic tendencies. I'm from the Dallas area, and her bleach blonde hair, manicured nails, nice car, and the water fountain in the front yard are not unusual. Most of the women I know there carry Louis Vuitton handbags to the nail salon every other week to get their fake nails manicured. I don't think that a mother of three just wakes up one day and decides to viciously stab her kids. Now, I agree, I wouldn't hold the blonde hair or the handbag or anything like that against her. It's also highly unusual for a female to kill in that way. She had no injuries to her palms, and with that amount of blood and the number of stab wounds, there would also be slippage. And she did all this with her husband upstairs? Look at the history. Women who kill their kids out of some bizarre motive do it privately, methodically, and without the mess. I've never heard of a planned stabbing like this. I've heard of the parent who has postpartum psychosis and the parent who loses her temper and lashes out. However, is there one case that you've ever heard of where a parent methodically plans the murder of her children and does it in the middle of the night with another parent in the house and in such a gory fashion? It doesn't make any sense. And why leave one alive? I just wish that you would revisit some of the alternative theories in this case. I think there is way too much room for error to have this woman sitting on death row. Darlie's case is very similar to another mother who was wrongly convicted of stabbing her 10-year-old son. On October 13, 1987, in Lawrenceville, Illinois, Julie Ree was awakened at 4 a.m. to the sound of her son's screaming. When she rushed to his room across the hall in the dark of the night, she collided with a child serial killer, Tommy Lynn Sells. He dropped the knife on the floor and began beating her with his fists. Despite physical injuries, including a gash on her arm, a black eye, bruises, and abrasions, Julie became the prime suspect. She was charged with capital murder 3 years later, after the elected prosecutor who resisted pressure to arrest her left office. After she was convicted in March of 2002, true crime author Diane Fanning published Through the Window, the terrifying true story of cross-country killer Tommy Lynn Sells. Sells told Fanning about a murder in Illinois in which he had killed a child and was startled by the mother who came into the room. Now, 2 years later, Texas Ranger John Allen provided an affidavit in support of Julie's petition for a new trial. the Illinois Innocent Project had corroborated the serial killer's confession. Julie was acquitted in a new trial, and the courts have issued her a certificate of innocence. I actually hope Darlie did do it. I do, because if she didn't, and she's been on death row for 20 years, there are just no words. I have spoken with her best friend from childhood. I have read the books that are for her and against her, as well as one that was highly biased, leaning towards her guilt, in which the author, Barbara Davis, later realized that she was wrong about her guilt, and currently donates all proceeds to her defense fund. There is not one person in her personal life who believes that she is capable of this act. Typically, when someone is a cold-blooded killer, hindsight is 20/20 for at least some people, and at least one person will come forward and say, yes, there was something really awful about that woman. I could see her doing that. But this is not the case with Darlie. I believe she's innocent. So, yes, I can see you definitely feel strongly about her innocence.
For sure.
I don't know. I mean, I wonder a lot about her husband, though.
Well, I think there's some involvement by him.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes, I wouldn't be surprised.
But all the evidence that was presented in terms of blood spatter and the kind of the recreation of how it happened, I think is the most likely explanation.
Yeah, I think the forensics really did seem to point to her, although I can see a lot of circumstantial stuff seems strange.
Yeah.
I mean, it certainly wasn't your typical murder. It's not something that you see a lot of. It is unusual. But she has had all of her appeals, and it looks like she will not be leaving death row.
Right.
No. But I say keep at it. You've got some good points there.
She does.
Okay, those are all the comments I have this week.
I don't have any more.
Okay. Before saying goodbye, I'd just like to thank our listeners for all the support you've given to True Crime Brewery. We get support in a variety of ways, as you know. First, we have our Tie Grabbers or Team Tie Grabber members for $2 a month, $3 a month, or even $5 a month. Members get access to our members-only premium full-length episodes. And members also get a gift for joining. It's a sticker, a credit card-sized bottle opener, or a snifter, depending on your contribution. Also, you can purchase merchandise at our store by clicking on Shop the Brewery at tiegrabber.com. And 5-star reviews on iTunes are very helpful. Also, if you can subscribe to us on iTunes, that helps our rating on iTunes. And we encourage everyone listening who shops on Amazon to click on our Shop Amazon and Support Tie Grabber link on our website. This will take you to Amazon, and if you do it this way, we get a small percentage of profits from Amazon.
Okay.
We'll talk to everybody next time.
We had some really good, thoughtful comments this week.
Oh, the feedback's been flowing in.
So yeah.
It's been great. I'm loving the feedback. It's actually, I probably spend almost as much time on the feedback now as the episode itself.
Yeah. And these in particular are pretty thought-provoking. Makes me think more.
That's good. Keep that brain active.
That's right.
Yep. Okay.
All right. See you next time.
See you at the quiet end.
Bye.
Bye-bye.